I see this all the time when I'm working with clients. It's like, so what team are you on? Well, I'm sort of on this one, and I'm kind of on that one. Or we'll say, well, let's get the team together to talk about this topic. And people will say, well, do you mean like the full team or the extended team or the core team?
The core team, yeah.
Right. So he talks about it should be obvious to anybody who's on the team and who's not. Mm-hmm. When we talk about teams, we always say that the definition of a team is a group of people that collaborate towards a shared goal.
Welcome to Agile for All's Humanizing Work Show. I'm Richard Lawrence.
And I'm Peter Green.
In season one, we focused on the four humanizing work themes: creativity, collaboration, impact, and growth, and dug into each of those. In season two, because most meaningful work happens in teams, we're focusing on teams and what makes teams great, what gets in their way, what we can learn from different kinds of teams. In this episode, we're going to look into the research around teams. Peter, you cite the research around teams a lot. What are some of the studies and authors that you point to the most, and what can we learn from them?
I think when I'm working with teams or teaching about teams, there are really three sources I tend to go to. A couple of them more research-based, one of them more kind of anecdotal patterns that they've noticed. I usually start with J. Richard Hackman. So Hackman was a Harvard researcher that studied teams of all types, work teams, sports teams, different contexts. He had five characteristics that he described. I also refer to Patrick Lencioni's book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and in some ways, the better follow-up, Overcoming the Five Dysfunctions of a Team, which is a brilliant business model. Describe the problems. And in book two, he actually describes a lot of the antidotes in the first book as well. And then the third source is a more recent one. Google has been publishing information about what they've noticed about great teams, what they've noticed about effective managers, and so I often cite the Google description of what they're learning about what makes effective teams at Google.
So let's start with Hackman's work. Mm-hmm. I know he looked at team composition and size quite a bit. What does he tell us about that?
Yeah, in fact, when I think about the five characteristics he talks about, one is clear membership. So who's on the team and who's not on the team? And I see this all the time when I'm working with clients. It's like, so what team are you on? Well, I'm sort of on this one, and I'm kind of on that one. Or we'll say, well, let's get the team together to talk about this topic. And people will say, well, do you mean like the full team or the extended team or the core team?
The core team, yeah.
Right. So he talks about it should be obvious to anybody who's on the team and who's not. Mm-hmm. When we talk about teams, we always say that the definition of a team is a group of people that collaborate towards a shared goal.
Mm-hmm. Not just a group of people.
Not just a group of people.
We see this on Scrum teams sometimes where you're a group of people that do meetings together,
right,
but you don't actually have a shared goal. Uh-huh. That doesn't feel like a team, and Hackman's work emphasizes that too.
It does, right.
We belong to a team.
Yeah, so that clear membership is pretty important. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that people can think about if they're struggling with, why doesn't this team feel like it's gelling or it's collaborating? One of the things they can think about is it clear who's on the team and who's not? Mm-hmm. And being not on the team is not like a mark against you or, oh, they're not valuable anymore. It's just clear that these are the people we can rely on day to day to collaborate with. Mm-hmm. We're committed together. So that's one of the things is that kind of clear membership of who's on it and who's not.
What does he say about team size?
Hackman talks about, and this is interesting because depending on the research, you'll see a whole bunch of different things. And I see research ranging from 6, 7, or 8. Depending on what source you're looking at. And I actually, off the top of my head, don't remember which one Hackman pointed to.
I think Hackman's was like 5.6.
5.6, right.
5.62 or something. Yeah, it was like almost comically precise.
Right. And so his was on the lower end of some of the research, right? Between 5 and 6, obviously, is what he's actually saying there. And
it seems like looking at sports teams would distort that a little bit because they're often defined by the rules of the game.
That's right. Yeah, so you're going to have 11 or 12 in some sports, where my favorite sport, basketball, is 5. So maybe that's why I love it so much, because it's closer to Hackman's recommendation of team size.
Basketball teams are the right size. Yeah.
But even if you look at, that's an interesting point, because if you look at the difference between how football is played and how basketball is played, to me, basketball is a little more faster moving. There are fewer pauses in a good game. And feels a little more improvisational than a football game, where it feels a little more structured. And probably part of that is due to the size of the team that's on the field at any one time. So I've seen research that talked about seven. There's like a bell curve around seven. That was more software focused, that research. So software teams tended to have a peak of productivity around seven. And then there's a rule in psychology that says beyond eight can't collaborate.
Where's that from?
I have no idea. This is from Luke Homan is where I heard this from. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to find it and I can't find it. So it might have been a framing that Luke gave. Luke, when you're watching this video, please give us the source of that quote. But I've noticed this, and what you see is that when groups get beyond eight, it takes facilitation structures to effectively collaborate there.
And subteams form sometimes.
And that's what happens on a team naturally. Is once you get beyond these numbers of six, seven, eight, then you see sub-teams starting to break out, and you don't really know how they just organically form.
Right.
In software teams, it's, you know, they start to subdivide into the people writing the code and the people testing it. In other things, it might be the people that do the research and the people that do the operations. So we start to see these sub-teams form around different goals.
I have changed my advice around team size. In sort of my early experience with agile processes like XP and Scrum, mm-hmm. there's the strong emphasis on about seven for a team. And it seems to fit with that research that mm-hmm. says, you know, above eight.
Right.
So we should focus on about seven. So my advice early on, and even things I did with my own teams, was, ooh, we're getting up into the 12, 13 range. We probably should split into mm-hmm. two teams.
Yeah.
And then I found we were spending a lot of time coordinating between two teams. So as the work becomes more complex, I think my tolerance for larger formal teams mm-hmm. has changed, because I want those appropriately sized sub-teams to be able to form organically rather than trying to fix those into the structure.
And so when you have had or been a member of those larger teams, what were some examples of sub-structures that emerged rather than being put in place?
Well, it might be around a particular feature. Mm-hmm. Like for this one, we need this skill.
Yeah.
For the next one, we don't, but that mm-hmm. skill is necessary somewhere else.
Right.
So it actually ends up looking like two teams in terms of how much work in progress there can be at any given time, mm-hmm. but it's fluid in terms of who needs to work on a particular thing.
Well, and I like that in your case, the sub-teams formed around value slices rather than competencies or skills.
Yep. Shared purpose.
Yeah.
It was, who do we need to accomplish this purpose? But there's the large purpose, and then there's the smaller immediate purpose that causes people to come together around that shared goal.
Yeah, and Hackman called that compelling direction when he talked about shared purpose. You know, what's the compelling direction? In other words, the direction that actually compels us, that moves us forward. I think of compel like a little bit like propel. What's the thing that pushes us forward, gets us excited, gets us up in the morning? Because on all teams, things get hard, we go through difficult times, and having that compelling direction or that purpose is the thing I think that helps us overcome that and still say, oh, yeah, this is going to be a hard day, but it's worth it because, right?
And I like compelling in there, because if we just say shared purpose, I think a leader could think, I put it on a poster. I declared what the shared purpose is for this team.
Right.
And now they have shared purpose, and therefore they're a team. But it may not be a purpose that feels at all connected to their own work.
Right.
And so it wouldn't be compelling at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think it's important that we make those connections to the work that people are doing. And, you know, we're back to the humanizing work theme of impact.
That's right, yeah. You
know, I need to feel like my work has a meaningful impact.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to go down the list of Hackman characteristics, the next one he talks about is enabling structures within a team. And enabling structures are like the playbook. If you were to use the sports analogy, if I join a new team, I need to learn the plays. I need to figure out what roles people play in different plays. And that's what enabling structures are. So as a team, we've worked out what are the structures we use in order to accomplish that purpose, in order to reach those goals and deliver value. So enabling structures, thinking about within the boundary of the team, how does work get accomplished? And then the next one is, he calls it supportive context, which is at the edges of that boundary, how does the team get into the team what they need? So that might be as simple as we need a computer, we need a tool, we need this. But it might be we need help understanding the direction. We need
feedback.
We need feedback from
customers.
Exactly. So can they get what they need from outside? So that he calls that supportive context. So I always think of those two as I think of them visually as what's going on inside the circle, and then how do we get stuff into the circle that we need in the circle? Yeah. And then the fifth one is a little bit related to that last question of how do we get things into the circle, which is competent coaching, which we don't read about or hear about in most of the other sources when we're talking about teams. But Hackman mentions that as a top five quality of what he noticed in really effective teams.
Let's dig into both those words. What is competent and what is coaching? Maybe not in that order for Hackman.
Well, and before we even get into those two things, I think it's important to point out that he said teams need competent coaching when they need it, not all the time.
So how do they know?
Yeah, and there are a couple of examples of that in some companies that we study about. So there's a company in the Netherlands called Buurtzorg, which is a home healthcare company. They have about 1,200 nursing teams that are completely self-organizing, autonomous. They completely own all things from hiring, firing, scheduling, and they are essentially the nurses for a neighborhood. It's kind of like a little startup, small company within that neighborhood. And so these nurses, they own everything, including hard decisions, like this person's not working out for us on the team.
Do they have enabling structures around those things?
They absolutely have enabling structures, so they have things like, and supportive context, in fact. So they have things like a really robust intranet of advice that people are sharing across all these teams. But then they have coaches, full-time coaches at Buurtzorg. I think it's around 50 coaches for 1,200 teams. And intentionally, that ratio is very low like that because they don't want the nurses to always rely on the coach. But I was actually listening to an interview with a nurse that was on one of these teams and had been for 7 or 8 years, and she was talking about this really difficult situation where they hired somebody. They thought she would be great. It turned out it just wasn't a good fit. And they went through some of their internal protocols to try and have some conflict resolution with that person, and they really felt stuck. That's when they reach out to the coach, and the coach comes in. And first the coach would help them try to kind of moderate the discussion, and see if they can come to a conclusion. Eventually, they realize this isn't, number one, it's not good for us, but number two, she's not happy as a nurse here as well. And so the coach really helped them uncover that and figure out what to do next, which was they found her a different job. But they kept employing her and paying her until she found that different job.
Outside the company.
Outside the company. Mm-hmm. And she found a different job where she was much happier, and they stayed friends. and had a good relationship beyond that. So that would be an example of where a coach, clearly they did everything that they could on their own, as far as they felt their skills and capabilities could take them, but then they needed help, and that's what the coaches were there. So that would be an example of a competence from that coach. In that case, the coaching was really on the HR side. How do you effectively do this? And how do you do it in a way that maintains relationships, where firing is often a time when relationships are broken, right? And people leave with bad feelings about it.
So much of our identity is wrapped up in work and our performance at work.
Right.
That firing feels like a blow to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the situation where teams don't know that they need coaching? We've certainly encountered those in our work where they think things are fine, and from the outside, it's a train wreck. Mm-hmm. What is the answer there when the model is we pull coaching when we need it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think in those models where we pull coaching where we need it, the teams are not operating in a vacuum, right? And so there are other teams around them, there are probably other leaders, there are other people in the organization that might be able to observe these things, mm-hmm. and reach out to that team and suggest, hey, I see a difference here.
So part of that supportive context is reflecting to them when they would need coaching.
Yeah, and then I think the other thing that we would say is, especially, let's take the scenario where you're on team A, team B seems to be struggling, you're not a member of that team, but we have this rule that they pull coaching when they need it. If I'm on team A, then I would look at some of our advice around, how could you make it visible that there's something that's a possibility for improvement there. I don't know if in Hackman's research he had examples of where the competent coaching was sometimes brought down upon the team versus the team pulling it. So it's not that he makes the point that it needs to be pulled. by the team. He makes the point that they need it when they need it, but not all the time.
Okay, that's
And so
true.
Who brings the coaching and who recommends that there's some coaching take place is not necessarily always a pull system.
So in the sports examples that he often looked at, the coach is a full-time role, or many roles, depending on the sport. And so it may be more about how the coach engages than whether they're there or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that with great coaches, is that great coaches are not just trying to stay busy 100% of the time doing coaching.
Right.
They're there when they're needed. And I think if we look at like a scrum master role, which by scrum is defined as a full-time role for a team, are they coaching full-time? The team doesn't need that.
Right.
In fact, if you're coaching full-time, that team is probably not growing the way that they could.
And you're probably driving people crazy.
Probably driving people crazy, right. And so that is, even for the full-time scrum master role, the coaching slice of that is not full-time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's talk about the other two sources. Mm-hmm. What do they add to Hackman's? Because I know there's some overlap.
A little bit, yeah.
Five items. So what are some of the unique angles brought by the other two?
I think that Lencioni brings a lot of the relationship aspect to great teams. So he talks about, he describes it as a pyramid, these five dysfunctions. And to make it easier, I'll describe the functional version of these things, the opposite of the dysfunction.
Right.
So he talks about at the base of the pyramid is trust. If the individuals on the team don't trust each other, then nothing else can be built on that. So we start with trust. If we have trust, then we can address conflict in a healthy way. So Hackman points out how healthy conflict is critical for a team's success. One of the benefits of a team is you have multiple perspectives, different viewpoints, and we can benefit from that. And so healthy conflict, the way that we can bring conflict into a conversation and have a healthy approach to that and benefit from it, so benefiting from conflict.
It strikes me that the five items in Hackman's list enable the two items in the bottom of Lencioni's pyramid. That if you have clear membership of your team and a compelling purpose, you have opportunities to build trust with each other,
right?
Because it's not just I've decided to trust you.
Right.
It's that from experience, over and over again, you've proven to me that you're not going to harm me, that you're going to do good for me. And so if we've got this compelling purpose that we're doing together and we're frequently working on that, I'm going to grow to trust you. And it's safe for us to have healthy conflict because we're both working towards a thing out here, and it's not about you and me, it's about us achieving this compelling purpose together.
It's interesting because I think you could make the case either direction, that the Lencioni things enable some of these things on Hackman's side.
It's iterative.
It is, right? And they are, I would say that they're good supporting sources.
Although I'm thinking about the order in which you could make them happen as a leader.
Yes.
For example. So a leader can create those enabling structure, supportive context, define a team, work with them to figure out a compelling purpose.
Yeah.
And now they've got a container in which they can build trust and practice healthy conflict, especially if there's competent coaching.
Yeah. It strikes me that what the leaders would focus on in Hackman's list is 1, 2, 4, and 5. In other words, clear membership, right? Compelling direction. Leadership could have a tremendous impact on those. Supportive context and competent coaching. Leadership provide those. And then the enabling structures within the team, we want the team to own the enabling structure. So I hadn't thought of that before, but what's the leader's role?
Leaders can help with a starting point.
Yeah.
And even offer some things so that every team doesn't have to make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Because
for sure.
a team who's an expert in developing some product is not automatically an expert in process and facilitation and tools around collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
So offering something like Scrum is this is something that has worked in many other places as a starting point to figure out what our own enabling constraints are could be really valuable.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the bottom two. As we build up the pyramid, what else is there?
So the next one is a willingness to make a commitment. So if we had this healthy conflict, I really thought this was the best thing to do. These team members really thought that was the best thing to do. We work out what really is going to be the best thing for our customer here, what outcome we're trying to create. And then we're willing to commit. And Lencioni points out that team members don't need to get their way in order to be willing to commit. What they need to do is feel heard by the other team members. So, I got to share my perspective. I really felt heard. Notice that feeling heard is a little bit different than being heard, right, on a team. So actually, I feel like the team really understood what I was, the point I was trying to make and why I cared about that. And now, even if the other direction is chosen, I'm still willing to commit because I felt heard. So when they're talking about commitment, they're talking about commitments to each other. We've made this decision. Now I'm committing that I'm going to take these actions based on that decision.
It seems like Hackman is looking at the team as the entity, mm-hmm. and Lencioni is zooming in and looking at the relationships between team members yeah. as the main thing yeah. to work on.
Yeah, if you think of the enabling structures part of Hackman, a lot of Lencioni is focusing on, well, what's the relationship aspect of those enabling structures? What relationship structures enable those the team to succeed? Yeah. And then once we've committed, then the next layer of the pyramid is holding each other accountable for what we did. And so if Richard committed to me to do something, then I'm going to hold him accountable and say, Richard, did you do that thing? And if Richard says, no, I didn't do it, then I can say, why not? What happened? What prevented you from doing it? What can we do so that that doesn't happen? So we're actually willing. Notice that that goes back to healthy conflict a little bit.
Right, because if I say, who are you to try to hold me accountable?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to back up a little bit to yeah. healthy conflict and figure out how to work with that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then finally, we could have all four of those aspects where people are making commitments, holding each other accountable for reaching those commitments. But if we don't actually focus on the result, that's the top of his pyramid, is that on top of all of those, now we can really focus on the results or the outcomes of what this team is trying to accomplish. So that's the Lencioni pyramid of the functional version of the five dysfunctions of a team.
Okay. And then as Google looked at their teams,
yeah.
What does their model add to the other two?
In some ways, it adds newer language to some of those things. So they don't describe it necessarily as a pyramid, but when you actually read through their work on rework.withgoogle.com, you can read all of this research. And they talk about psychological safety as the bottom of the proverbial pyramid, again, even though they are not necessarily drawing it that way.
That's the foundation.
The foundation piece is psychological safety. So psychological safety means I'm willing to take a risk with these people. And I'm willing to show up and be vulnerable with these people. And it's interesting because when Lencioni talks about trust, he says the only way you can create trust between team members is for people to display vulnerability, which is an interesting way to think about that, that everybody knows that nobody in this room is perfect. But if we're doing what Robert Keegan calls the second job, at most companies, of managing our perception and making sure that we come off as really good and competent, then we're trying to hide our vulnerability, right? And so he says the only way that we build trust is to admit that we are imperfect mm-hmm. and display that vulnerability. And that doesn't mean that I'm coming in and, you know, weeping on Richard's shoulder and saying I'm such a bad person. Right. It's not that kind of emotional display, but it's an honest admitting when I don't know, when I'm worried. That's what creates trust, and that's also what creates that psychological safety, is a willing to take those risks. So those are pretty similar, but different language. And there is research in the psychological field around what psychological safety means. So they're bringing some of that research into that idea of what does trust actually look like. It looks like I feel safe here to take a risk, to admit if I'm having a hard time. That's at the base for them.
Anything else that their model adds to the other two?
They describe some of the commitment and accountability as dependability. We can count on each other. They talk about clarity and structure, which is a lot about some of the Hackman stuff. I find it interesting that their last two in their five are meaning of the work and impact of the work.
And they distinguish between those two.
They do, because when you first, if you just read the words, you think, well, aren't those both around compelling right. direction or shared yeah. purpose? And the way they describe it is that meaning of the work is the type of work I do is meaningful to me. It's fun. It's where I'm growing. It's, you know, where I'm competent. So it's like I have mastery in this area, if we want to use the Dan Pink language yeah. around that.
Or play in the uh-huh. prime perform language.
Play in the prime perform language, exactly. And so it's meaningful work. And, it's, you know, it's Google, so if I'm a AI, machine learning, and I love solving those types of problems, then I get to solve that type of problem.
And so that'd be meaningful even if there's no impact mm-hmm. to it.
Exactly. And the impact of the work is it makes a difference for somebody in the long run, which is directly aligned with our language and the humanizing work themes around impact.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Let's make it practical. Mm-hmm. What are a few things that our audience can do with the teams that they're on to make some of these 15-ish things more true in
well,
their work.
Yeah, as I described these, there were probably one or two of them. It's probably not all 15, but there might have been one out of all these 15 characteristics of teams that somebody heard and said, you know, we don't do that very well on our team.
And I think it's often the first two from Hackman.
Uh-huh.
The clear membership and the compelling direction.
Yeah.
You get those right, I think you have a context to work out a lot of the other ones.
That's right. And so for somebody that's on a team that doesn't have any influence over who's on the team and who's not, what advice would you give them about how to create more, you know, clear membership?
If you can't fix it, make it more visible.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I would begin conversations about who's actually on this team and what does it mean to be on this team.
Right. And what are some of the results of not having that clear membership?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, make visible things like multitasking.
Uh-huh, yeah. And similarly with compelling direction.
For someone who doesn't have the power to directly set that. So we're not talking to a product owner who's really empowered to set direction. And
or a CEO or a founder of a startup.
Right, yeah. If you're just a member of a team and you don't feel like you have a compelling direction as a team, one of my favorite things to do is make visible what you think it is. You know, take a stab at a vision and say, I think this is what we're working on, and then bounce it off other people and triangulate on what the compelling direction is.
Yeah, sometimes you can start a little bit of a movement, right? You can start the conversation here, and then if the person that should be doing that work or that others would expect to do that work because of their role gets wind that, hey, those folks over there are talking about vision, I think I'm supposed to be in charge of that, then they'll either go shut it down, say, hey, that's my job, and say, great, we can't wait to see what yours is, and see how we can align around that. It'll cause some motion to happen, right? And so even if you feel like you don't own something, you can often influence it by giving it a start, creating some space on the team for discussions around that.
Mm-hmm. One variation on that I've seen a few times is making visible both the kind of stated direction and the de facto direction.
Yeah.
And so this is what we say we're about, and this is our compelling direction as stated when we're talking about things like vision.
Yeah.
This is our direction as revealed by the things we actually work on.
Yeah.
It's tricky to do the second one in a way that is empathetic, because if you get that wrong, that's going to create some conflict you don't need to create. But if you can say, it really seems like this is what we value, and put it in a good light, but show that there's a conflict between those things, you can drive some conversations around, what is it really? Maybe our real vision is not the stated one, but the one we actually behave like we have.
The other thing I love about that idea is that then a way that you could state that really empathetically is that if you're talking to that person, you could say, you know, I know that you believe in this vision and that it's meaningful to you, and yet we pretty consistently make decisions to do these things in this different direction. Let's talk about what's causing us to consistently choose to do things that are not aligned with that vision, and maybe we can, you know, remove some of those barriers or change some of those influences that are causing us to do that over and over again.
Yeah, and the way you phrased that without asking why made it sound more empathetic rather than challenging.
That's one of our interview techniques and coaching techniques is we never say, why did you do that? We always say, what caused you to do that? Because that puts people off, you know, at ease and say, oh yeah, well, something caused me to do it. What was that, right? Yeah. Good. So there are lots of, we could go through all 15 and give our advice, but that would make a really long episode. And
We don't know what their thing is.
Exactly.
So these are just a couple examples.
But if you think of some of the patterns from how we would address those two, one is if you can't change it, make it visible. And so if you're looking at one of these 15 characteristics, this would be a good chance to say, how could we make that thing visible or the absence of that thing visible? The other one is just start having conversations about it. And it doesn't have to be with a team leader. It can just be with another peer. And so if you've identified one of these that either you feel like would make a huge difference on the team, one of these 15 characteristics, or you feel like often there's one that's like, we're so close to doing that well, and if we could just push it over, it would make a huge difference. So find one of those and either make it visible, figure out how to make it visible, or just start having conversation with other team members. And see if you can cause that conversation to happen in a way that's empathetic and that it causes the conversation to ripple out and start to attract more and more members of the team into the conversation.
We want to hear from you. Share in the comments below what you've been trying on your teams or what you're going to try based on this conversation. And if you're familiar with any other research on teams that's been useful to you, we want to hear about it. As always, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.